Collective Tap. We are going to be continuing our conversation about water. Water is very complicated, and it's sometimes hard to understand the connections between supply, demand, what data we have, how we plan for it, and so forth. I'm Gabe Filippelli, and this is actually season 5 of the Collective Tap, podcasting from the beautiful College of Communication at Butler University. This is the last episode in this season we've called Boiling Point, lifting the lid on Indiana's urgent water issues. Throughout the season, we've slogged through wetlands, we've graded rivers, and Indiana better get a tutor because our rivers are not doing that well. We've demystified PFAS, hopefully, for some people. Today, we're going to really explore our water resources and how we plan for and control our water resources. A great example is this one. In 2022, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation's LEAP, Lebanon Innovation and Research District, started to become a reality. This is about a 9,000 plus acre development designed to house the next generation of biotech, pharmaceutical, and life science companies. And already, companies like Eli Lilly, Cummins, Roche, and others are committed. But almost no sooner than they got started, they found out there wasn't enough water locally to support the needs of the planned development. What ensued has, to put it lightly, has been complicated and controversial, eventually requiring the governor to step in and take some action to try to help calm concerns and keep the project on track. We can talk about some of the challenges the LEAP project encountered and how the state has reacted, but maybe for now we can just acknowledge that water is hard. Our water resources have so many different users, so many different and sometimes competing demands by individuals, companies, utilities, farmers, and others who count on having reliable access to water. Yet we don't actually know all that much about it. Where is there water? How much water is there? How can we find out and avoid scenarios like LEAP wound us up in? On this episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by Jack Whitman. He's a geoscientist and vice president of the Midwest at Anterra Incorporated, and Emily Fennell, Great Lakes Senior Advisor and Strategist in the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. And today we're talking about regional planning and state-level planning and how we can better understand and manage our water resources. Welcome to the Collective Tap, Jack, Emily.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to dive right in to the big picture. We have water, obviously. We get rained on. We have groundwater resources. We have lakes and rivers and so forth. And waters are not disconnected, right? Water's connected across regions, across states, across nations. Emily, I love your title. You have this title, Great Lakes Senior Advisor and Strategist. I'm not sure what senior strategist is. I'm not sure it's a very common job title in state government, but how did that designation come about, and what does being a senior advisor and strategist entail? So you are the czar of water.
Thanks, Gabe. So I have been with the Office of the Great Lakes in Michigan for over 25 years, and I've spent most of my career working on long-term collaborative multi-stakeholder water planning, specifically focused around the Great Lakes, but more recently in the mid-early 2000s, around 2015-16, I was really heavily involved in developing the state's Michigan water strategy. And so basically that means that I bring diverse interests together and support strategic planning around gathering groups' diverse interests and finding that common ground and developing a common vision, and then laying out an implementation plan so that we have a way to achieve that vision.
We are definitely going to dive into Michigan State Water Plan because it might serve as a model of sorts for other areas, including the state of Indiana. Jack, I want to turn to you. You've been diving and swimming around the water issue for your entire career. And a lot of your work has been in Indiana, although you've worked other places as well. Two questions for you. One is, first, how do you approach the water issues here in the state of Indiana? What's your overall kind of 30,000 foot view of it? And second, I want to have you explore a little bit about what happens when it rains on a farm field, let's say.
Well, the 30,000 foot view from a hydrologist perspective, I look at the rivers themselves as kind of the first indicator of where is the water and how much do we have and how much is there. So one of the things that Indiana has is it has a lot of big rivers. So the Wabash River is fairly large, and it's undammed throughout its entire main stem, which is unusual for such a long river. And when you look at all of the rivers of the state, one of the things that comes out of that is that you can see where, also, what bodies are what tributaries or what aquifers are feeding that river. So rivers like the Kankakee in the state of Indiana, when it rains really hard, it doesn't simply flood right away because of all the sandy soils. So you have this long peak that occurs in the river that is really reflecting all of the recharge that happened and all of the slowed down discharge into the river from that rainfall event. When you look at the Wabash River, it's kind of the opposite. The Wabash River is in a clay till landscape. So a lot of the water doesn't go right into the river, or actually goes right into the river from the top of the soil as runoff. And so it doesn't have these kind of continuous aquifers that feed it slowly. It has a few places where it hits those aquifers, but it really is more of a surface water drain from the landscape. And to get to the other question, indirectly a little bit, is that in the state of Indiana, it rains about 3 or 4 feet a year, so in between the two. And everywhere around the state, if you caught all of the rain that came out of most basins, about 1 foot comes out of the drainages where there were 3 or 4 feet that it rained on that basin. So the first question is, what happened? Well, that's evapotranspirated back into the atmosphere for the next rainfall event that it happens, you know, further to the east usually here. So I'm interested in trying to understand both what remains in the river, how much can we subtract from that amount without affecting it. So I'm really interested in understanding the dynamics of how river basins and aquifers interact and how you can use kind of new tools with kind of old equations, but new tools to answer the questions that people have about water resources and water supply.
Evapotranspiration, right? Very fancy word. It's the magic that plants do when they convert carbon dioxide into organic matter. One of the products is water vapor, right? And
so
plants are just pumping water into the air constantly,
to make seeds, right? Yeah. I mean, it is agriculture. That part is just how we make things here and we grow things, and that's part of our economy.
So I'm going to stick with you for one more second, Jack. How do we move water around, right? So if I want water and I'm here, if I have too much water in one location, how can I get it to another location? What goes on with water in terms of distributing it? Is it easy to drain the Lake Michigan and water our lawns in Indianapolis, for example?
Well, that's a funny question because movement. You have to move water from point A to point B. And most of what your water utility does is moves water from where it is to where it needs to be and where it needs to be used. So you have around the town of Bloomington, Indiana, there is only really one source of supply, and it's in a reservoir that's south of town. So in order for that water to get to my house, it travels 17 miles over rock, which there's no real water between the two points. So it goes 17 miles piped through treatment plants, through pump stations, and through large capacity reservoirs to eventually get to my house on the west side of town. So it's very normal in Indiana to move water 10 or 20 or 30 miles. That's not uncommon. As you go further south in our state, that becomes common. So we have reservoirs in the southern part of Indiana that are the supplies for counties around them. So there might be 50 miles of pipe that are put on the landscape in order to move it from the reservoir to the homes. But in the northern part of the state, it's almost the reverse. Mm-hmm. Everyone has water underneath their feet. There are aquifers almost under every home. So you have a lot more homeowner wells in the northern part of the state. And most municipal supplies don't really need to talk to each other because their use of water doesn't affect the other neighbor's use of water. And then in the middle of the state, so I just described the south and the north, the middle of the state is a patchwork. It's actually critical that you understand how much you'll need before you start looking for water, because there are some rivers and some aquifers, but they're not everywhere. And if you assume they're there, you'll be, you know, sad about the outcome oftentimes. But the whole idea is, in the middle of the state, the answer to your question changes depending on where you are as to how far you normally move water.
No, that's interesting. And I think that this is an area that people don't really understand, that not only is it regionally different, so therefore regional planning has to be different, or state level planning, but this concept that the water you see in your rivers is not necessarily, and the reservoirs, isn't necessarily all of the water that you end up drinking, right? Because groundwater supplements a lot of that.
That's correct.
And this is a point we're going to get to toward the end. We have a fair amount of data on rivers and reservoirs, their capacity, their supply. Aquifers, maybe not so much. So I'm going to get to that in a little bit with you. Emily, as Michigan went through its water policy development process, which you know intimately since you were part of it from the get-go, the term Michigan's water heritage seemed to come up. And I wish Indiana had a water heritage. I don't think we do, not necessarily a strong ethos of water, but, you know, Michigan really does. It starts from the lakes, and then it ends up in the streams and so forth. And it was used in a lot of the public conversations and communications. What did and what does that mean? When you say Michigan's water heritage, what does that mean? And how would you describe what Michiganders mean by that? And does having a heritage connected to water make them embrace water resources a little bit more deeply?
Sure. So Michigan's water heritage is really important to the people of our state, because water really defined our state, and it's really ultimately why people came to the Great Lakes region to settle here. Native people originally came to the region because of native wild rice, Manomen, and we have since seen lots of economic opportunity that has created a lot of growth in our region, from the massive lumbering era that happened in our state, from commercial fishing that occurred that's dependent on the lakes. We also have the ability to move goods and people across the Great Lakes through our maritime economy. And then it's really that access to water that led to the industrial boom and the industrial age in our state. And so the history of water to the people and our communities and our story is very important. And you ask anyone in Michigan if they love the Great Lakes, and everybody raises their hands. But one of the things that we really wanted to understand deeply when we were developing the Michigan Water Strategy, which was that long-term water policy planning document, was how do people value water, and how does that value and love for our Great Lakes and our water resources show up in the types of behaviors and decisions that they make about being good stewards? You know, we're very blessed to have basically our entire state within the Great Lakes Basin, other than a very small portion of Gokebit County in the Upper Peninsula. But that creates some unique challenges. Because we have abundant water, we don't have a culture of scarcity. We have a culture of abundance. And so, you know, we've seen in the history in the Great Lakes region where industries and factories were built along the Great Lakes in our ports and harbors, and a lot of waste and pollution was disposed in the water. Now we're seeing this renaissance of communities turning their faces back to the water and making that a vibrant, clean, healthy space for communities, for people and families to gather. And so the water strategy is intended to be this 30-year roadmap of achieving a vision for the future where we can use and enjoy our resources in a way that's sustainable, both from a sustainable water-based economy and all the ways that water is important to our economy, like agriculture and operating our water utilities for drinking water, as well as for, you know, industrial cooling and things like that. So it's making sure that we are deeply connecting with people in terms of how they value water and their personal value and connection to water, and making that part of how we're driving this vision forward and making sure that we're building those connections and strengthening those over time.
Excellent. And I'm going to, in a bit, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the nitty-gritty of developing the plan. But Jack, when I said that, made the offhand comment that Indiana doesn't seem to have a water ethos, I saw you roll your eyes a bit. Tell me, what do we not? Does a state legislature care that much? What's going on?
I've probably read too many things about the history of how water has been used or managed, let's say, in the state. part of what we have is we have a history of, along with many other states in the middle of the country, we built canals. So we were a part of the, I think, the Erie Canal and other, where they were moving. It was before there were interstates. They had to move goods, as was pointed out. And the idea of building this canal became a huge economic investment that states were making at a very bad time, because it was just before the railroads were getting going. So there were like two competing ways to move product around the new states that were forming. And the other reason I rolled my eyes is because I was thinking about the Kankakee Great Marsh. And the Kankakee Marsh, the part that was in Indiana, was near the dimensions of the Everglades. It was some huge fraction of what the Everglades were, and so, or are now, I guess. But at the time, because it was because Chicago was being developed, because railroads had to get through, because all of the states were trying to create themselves kind of from the ground up, literally, there was a movement to drain that area so that there could be transportation, agriculture, and normal, let's say, pioneer uses of the land. So we have a history, let's say, but it isn't the same as, we don't have the affection, I think, that you might if we had at Great Lakes, and other than the one crescent that's at the very northwestern corner of the state. Our state has a history of industry. We have a history of industry and agriculture, and I think we are informed by that politically and otherwise, because that's really where the energy of our state goes. And I think that is the story of Indiana, is kind of we're an industrial state. We use a lot of water in a similar way to Michigan. Indiana actually uses as much or more than Michigan does for just normal industrial operations. So I think we need to understand it because of the character of the work that we are creating here, and we need to make decisions with some information and insight as to how to develop these new facilities, because we really are entering a new industrial age, and we have to understand what this new industrial age requires. And one of the things that it does require is water supply. So mapping water sounds like it takes time and effort to go through the process, but it's the only way the industry that is here can continue to stay. We need this. This is our future. This is our children's future. So I think we have to kind of take the path that Michigan has been on and really try to come up with ways to appreciate and understand and value water resources.
So I will then turn, I'm going to ask you in a minute a question about regional planning and
sure.
Who owns the water under your feet, who owns water under my feet at any one time. But since you segued to the state planning process, who kicked that off? What organization or person started that? What was the process? What was the timeline? What were the communities of interest that were contacted? What information and data did you use to construct that plan?
Sure. So we began the Michigan Water Strategy at the request of our previous governor, Governor Rick Snyder. So he issued a special message on the energy and environment, calling for the creation of a comprehensive statewide water strategy that really focused on place attachment for communities and people, so that human connection, as well as how water is important to our economy. And there really wasn't a timeline set out before us to achieve his goal. Those were the pillars that were given to us as guideposts to stay within. And so we put together an interagency steering committee to help us frame out some draft goals and outcomes. And we really took a different approach than government had taken in the past, particularly in Michigan, and that we just started with those draft goals and outcomes. We had an external advisory group we called affectionately our water cabinet. And we built a comprehensive engagement process to really do a listening tour around the state. And we hosted regional conversations. So different than Indiana, Michigan doesn't manage water and regional planning organizations. It's more on a statewide basis, but there's obviously a lot of variability in geology and different types of water features in regions across the state. We have our upper and lower peninsula, so they have very different types of economies, and our population is more concentrated in our urban centers in Detroit and southeast Michigan, and also on the west side of the state. So we held meetings around each of these regions, and we really wanted to make sure that we were bringing that community and economic development perspective to the table from, you know, past environmental planning efforts. We're typically going to the environmental and conservation NGO community and government. In this case, we really wanted to be intentional about broadening and being more diverse so that we could focus on that goal the governor had laid out. So it was about an 18-month listening tour, and we had conversations in rural, urban communities, environmental justice communities. Although that wasn't the focus at the time, but really tried to have some diversity and perspectives because the strategy was intended to focus on the next generation. So over the next 30 years, how do we want to use and enjoy our water resources? What strategies do we need to put in place? Where are there opportunities to really drive innovation and technology forward? So I think similar to Indiana, that's been a big focus in Michigan too. And so overall, the process took about 4 years. We went back on the road after we did this initial listening tour to share a draft strategy and get feedback and input from those same groups that we had engaged before. And then we asked folks, you know, where do they see themselves in the water strategy? Where do they see themselves in the recommendations or the content? Where do they want to own a piece of it, be the cajoler, the convener, the implementer, the funder? And that really led to a lot of success with buy-in and implementation of the strategy. And so in terms of being data heavy, it's really at that 50,000 foot level. On a policy standpoint, there's obviously a lot of data that supports the recommendations and the work that's happening. But it was very broad and intending to be very strategic and not necessarily comprehensive on all the science and data around resource management. That all supports the recommendations, but it was really intended to be more of that collaborative decision-making process and helping to support water governance at the individual, community, and regional and statewide level.
Great. And I know this is your baby and all, but what do people like it?
We have seen great success in the implementation of the strategy. One of the key messages that we and philosophies that we took from the beginning is this is not a strategy for government to go and do and implement. You know, we recognize in Michigan we have thousands of municipalities and jurisdictions at the local level that are making decisions that impact water quality and quantity. So we were talking earlier about, you know, really helping communities understand that we live in a hydrologically connected system. What happens in an upstream community affects downstream communities. And so we wanted to make sure that people could see themselves and how this would be implemented. But we've seen tribal governments working together collaboratively with the state to help implement and develop statewide wild rice stewardship plans, something that was written by the tribes into the document itself, where we worked very collaboratively. So, you know, those priorities of various groups and obviously our Native people, having that stitched into the fabric of the document, I think led to its success. Other groups that were part of our external advisory group, they embedded all of the goals from the strategy, there are 9 of them, into their strategic plan for their organization. And they said, every project and every partnership that we develop, we need to make sure that every one of these goals is embedded. Things like stewardship, sustainable water-based economies, healthy ecological systems, monitoring systems. We also saw the business community embrace it. We saw the Realtors Association hosting regional conversations with groups around the state and talking about development of their own water strategy implementation plans. So there were lots of different ways that we saw uptake and success. And that was at the time we released it in 2016, and this work is still happening now. So to me, not having contributed to another plan that was set on the shelf that just collects dust, but to see this one actually get put into action and by others outside of the agency finding their own resources and taking that initiative is really powerful.
I'm envious. But in the meantime, in Indiana, we approach water, as we mentioned, a little bit differently. We have some regional planning processes that are often watershed specific. And Jack, you pointed out one of the key differences. So when we talk about regional planning, it probably is a little bit more data informed because the region's hydrology is different throughout the state, like you articulated mm-hmm. earlier. When you work on this, so I'm going to get back to my initial question that will inform this a little bit. You told me a story before we started about an area that had gone through this period of likely over-extraction, right? And that only showed up eventually in some data that was collected, over-extraction of groundwater resources in this case. Two questions for you is, who owns, I have a piece of property, 1,000 acres, can I just pump willy-nilly and just pour it onto my fields or into the ditch? Who owns that subsurface water at that scale?
Water in our state is owned by everyone collectively. Okay, so that's before it's pumped out of the ground. The rivers, the aquifers, the water in the system of all of our hydrologic systems in the state is owned by everyone in the state. And so we've also identified the Department of Natural Resources as the manager of, or the state as the manager of all the resources. So the DNR is one of its divisions or one of its groups is just there for the purpose of managing the resources of the state. And the approach we use, which is very economical, is to wait for some kind of activity that is going on to create a problem for others. And when that happens, when a high-capacity well extracts enough water to dewater homeowner wells that are in the vicinity, so these are usually much shallower wells, 20, 30, 40 feet wells that are dewatered by the pumping of a high-capacity user, they are allowed to, requested to kind of go to the DNR, to have the DNR make an assessment of that overuse, and then require that high-capacity user to make up for that. The problem is that, in my view, that if we had monitoring data points, we would see it before it happened. We don't need to make huge investments in the high-capacity wells that might have caused this problem, and then you have another problem afterwards that you should have even budgeted for, but you didn't know that ahead of time. My understanding and my profession really is about being able to predict, being able to determine what happened. And when we have data points out in the world, and we have over 100, less than 200, I think, total data points that are monitoring wells in the state DNR system, something like that, 100 or so. And so that means there's about one or two in every county, except a lot around the city, but quite a few. And the whole question was that I was asking is, can we see something happen in these data sets that we've been collecting forever? Has anyone ever actually tried to say what's going on here with a data set? So I've done that, and I've found places where when the pumping went over a certain value, the water levels in that monitoring well continue to fall and still continue to fall. So we have not connected the dots, the literal points on the map where we see these data and we have these data sets. We haven't figured out how to use that insight that we gain from looking at the response of those water levels, water tables in these shallow aquifers. We need to connect that back to the development before it happens so that we can actually answer the question when people ask, well, how much can we pump out of this aquifer? There's an answer, and it's not a tricky thing to compute. It's just, it takes time. And so my enthusiasm and my whole joy of this is that we can anticipate problems before they occur as long as we think about it ahead of time. And it seems to me that that's the only advantage humans have, and we should be using it, you know, trying to anticipate the consequences of our action. It seems to me that understanding the impacts of withdrawals is a part of understanding the water supplies we have and what is the sustainable amount that we can pump and use from our resources.
So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right?
Yes, definitely.
This is true of natural systems as well. They sometimes recover more slowly than we would like them to.
And just to throw this in, because it's to me, it's important. When water utilities were asked in 2006 at the Aspen Institute, they were asked, what part of this, of your system, is not being valued properly? The unanimous response was watersheds and aquifers that are not on the ground of the utility, that are basically the upstream, everything upstream of them. And they said, that's part of our infrastructure. I think that's really how we have to think about this. We have to think about the streams and the aquifers are the infrastructure we're not paying for. And we need to think about how they're operating, how they're working, and what we're doing to them in order to really manage the resource, I think.
I like how you frame that infrastructure, because, Emily, you're talking about waterways as transit routes, and you were too. I mean, they are literally, they can be the roads of goods and services. They're also the critical ingredient for almost all manufacturing. And I wanted to switch to kind of thinking about the future. Emily, you brought it up. This water plan is for the next 30 years. There's going to be a lot of changes in the future. There's always a lot of changes in every future we have, right? So there's changes in development. There's changes in technologies. But there's also kind of overriding change. Climate change has impacted water distribution, at least across Indiana to some extent. I don't know if it's showing up in aquifers yet. It may or may not be. But it's changing some things. What pieces, when you said 30 years in the future, what were those ingredients that you were figuring into the equation?
That's a good question. You know, I think that we were, a couple of important things that we were looking at was, you know, how do we build better water governance? How do we build capacity of local and elected leaders to understand the impact of their daily decisions on water quantity and water quality? That was a theme that we heard across the state in all of the regional conversations. And so in Michigan, interestingly, one of our other project partners is Michigan Sea Grant, and they developed the Michigan Water School, which is a online virtual school that local and elected officials can participate in to provide just basic information about what is a watershed? We live in a hydrologically connected system. Where does my community's drinking water come from? Is it surface water, one of the Great Lakes, or is it groundwater? What is source water protection? What are some best practices and good zoning and planning tools that, as a community leader and elected official, I can use to help better plan for and make better decisions that will support long-term sustainability of our water resources? You know, and how do my decisions as a local leader affect my neighboring community? Those are some of the kind of long-term thinking that we put into these recommendations. That's something in Michigan, we have term limits in our state legislature. Many of our local and elected officials at the community level become state legislators. And so this is an ongoing program that we will need to do perpetually to educate these individuals, because ultimately they are going to be the ones that support our budgets, that give us resources to implement the kinds of water use programs that we were just talking about, do the data collection, put the stream gauges in the rivers, pay for the staff resources to make sure we're managing our water resources, and we need to know what we're managing, so we have to monitor, and we need to be able to measure the impacts of all of these programs and resources. So I think those were the kinds of ways that we thought about the recommendations that were included in the strategy that have that generational impact. And again, that was a recommendation that we didn't make that group go ahead and pursue funding and develop. They saw the need and they filled in that gap and they took ownership of that recommendation. And now that program is available for all of our community leaders around the state.
That's wonderful. Now, can we aspire to Michigan's level of integration of the different communities of interest and the organizations in terms of maybe developing a state water plan?
I think a state water plan will be developed over the next 5 years or so. I think that's what's going to happen. What is probably going to be different is the building blocks of the plan itself, because our state began the process by looking at water availability, a kind of the water quantity only kind of question of how much water is in which basin of the state. So we've been looking at river basins and then estimating the total amount of water that's there at all by coming up with this assessment of the low flow condition all over the state in different basins. We can actually talk about the effects of different users and what levels of use might be needed. Also, we're forecasting future needs in those same areas to try to match up the amount of water that's available to the needs of the communities that are using it, whether it's agriculture or new industrial uses, et cetera. So there's a need for a kind of different program, but it's, I think that Michigan, like many of the other states around us, they've really focused, at least in Michigan, they focused on getting people to talk about the subject, getting information about how people think about their own connection to water, which we really haven't done much of either. We've just begun that process. What we need to do in Indiana is really, I think, make a commitment to look at the entire state, to not have gaps in our own understanding of how much water is available in different basins. And then once we have that information, I think that we can change and alter what we do in the state with, I think, different investment. I think we need to invest much more in the state to do this work.
Well, you've laid out what I would consider my final question, was what does the future hold? You have a bold prediction of 5 years, we'll have a state water plan we'll begin the process of building one where we'll bring the stakeholders together. And we might be shifting our ethos, embracing water again.
I think so because I've been in the middle of it for the past decade or so. And what I've seen is that the business community is shifting their attention to water. And it's been partly because of these glitches that have occurred because of decisions that were made without understanding of the availability of the resource. And so I think the business community says, wait a minute, if we're going to take advantage of all the other good things in Indiana, we need to understand this other piece of the puzzle. And I think that the business community will drive it in the direction of prediction, which is what I think we want. We want to be able to know ahead of time that what we're doing is not going to hurt us in the future or hurt our children. So sustainability is a locked-in kind of metric. We want to know that what we're doing is sustainable forever. We're not hurting the landscape in some way. So I think that the state of Indiana is right at where it should be. It's informing itself. It's learning how to do it. It's talking to the neighbors, which is really important. So I think that together, these pieces of the puzzle will result in some kind of useful plan for the state of Indiana.
Fantastic. The human superpowers, right? Data and prediction based on data.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yeah.
Emily, final question for you then, or your kind of perspective, similar one that I just gave to Jack. In Michigan's context, what does the future success look like? It sounds like you've already had some really profound successes. What's next?
You know, I think we need to do more work in terms of looking at water availability around the state. And doing that additional data collection, we've got some tremendous investments going into our water use program right now to create a groundwater data warehouse to help us better understand all the data that we do have so we can make better, more informed decisions in terms of managing our groundwater resources. And thinking about the future in terms of climate impacts, we're also interested in doing more research and looking at where's the science telling us that we need to be adjusting our approaches and resource management, changing our landscape practices, and how do we get better data and information about that so we can be more informed about what the future may bring, recognizing that, you know, there's a lot of different climate scenarios for our state and the Great Lakes region, But we want to be very adaptive and prepared for what those potential changes might bring, and hopefully more people moving back into the Great Lakes region and into our state. So I think more science, more data, more information, and better integration of all of that together to help inform good policy development and decision making.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thanks so much. That's actually very positive places to end this on. I've been joined by Emily Fennell, Great Lakes Senior Advisor and Strategist in the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes and Energy, and Jack Whitman, Geoscientist and Vice President of Midwest at Intera Incorporated, and I think lifelong Hoosier, perhaps. So thank you very much for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to thank Butler University for sponsoring the podcast and hosting us here. Our thanks also to the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust for making it all possible. You can find us online at The Collective Tap. It's all one word, thecollectivetap.com, and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This is the last episode for this season of The Collective Tap. We hope you found this series illuminating and look forward to bringing you more conversations about water soon. Thank you so much for listening.